to the Student Press Law Center podcast for December 2009, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is an advocate for student voices. We recognize the essential role that free speech and a free press play in a democratic society, and the SPLC is committed to nurturing and protecting those freedoms for the next generation. For more information about the center's work, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lamonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. When you think about a disciplinary hearing at a college campus, you probably picture some kid getting in trouble for sneaking beer into the dorm or maybe cheating on his midterm exams. Or maybe you think about Dean Wormer and Animal House and fraternities being put on double secret probation for too much partying. But there's nothing funny about the kinds of cases that campus disciplinary boards are being asked to decide today. Some of them are cases that would be serious felonies punishable by serious prison time if they occurred anywhere other than on a college campus, and that includes sexual assault. One of the selling points for bringing a case to a campus judicial body instead of to the police or the district attorney is that college disciplinary systems are set to protect privacy. But the secrecy of these proceedings poses real dangers to the participants and real challenges for members of the media trying to cover what are often highly newsworthy events. In the real-world justice system, the participants have two sets of protections. First, they have all the rules of the legal system to guarantee that the evidence used against them is legitimate. Those rules of evidence don't apply strictly in a college disciplinary setting. And second, they have the protection of public scrutiny so that judges who make indefensible decisions get held accountable for their behavior. And unfortunately, that transparency also is lacking in the campus disciplinary system. So when the fairness of that system breaks down, it's extremely hard for the public to find out and demand that it be reformed. Reporter Kristen Lombardi is with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit producer of investigative journalism, and Kristen Lombardi has just published the first wave of her findings after a 9-month-long investigation by the center into the workings of these secretive campus courts. The series is titled Sexual Assault on Campus, A Frustrating Search for Justice, and it's available on the center's website, which is www.publicintegrity.org. Kristen Lombardi, thank you for being with us on the SPLC podcast, and please start by telling people who may be unfamiliar a little bit about who the Center for Public Integrity is and the kind of work that you do.
Thank you, Frank, for inviting me. It's great to be here. Well, just like you said, the Center for Public Integrity is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization. Our mission is producing original investigative journalism of public concern. Investigative journalism in the public interest. And, you know, the center has been around for almost 2 decades. It was started by Chuck Lewis, who was a former 60 Minutes producer who felt constrained by commercial media, the time and space constraints that go along with commercial media. And he set out to found this organization, the model for which has become quite common nowadays with the dissolution of the print newspaper and you know, investigative units at those newspapers being disbanded. There are a lot of local nonprofit investigative journalism organizations cropping up. The center is nationally focused, and we do in-depth stories and investigative projects on subjects, you know, really any subject of public concern. We don't do daily reporting, so sometimes our stories will take months or even years to produce.
Well, tell us how the concept for the Sexual Assault on Campus series came about.
Well, I've been an investigative reporter. I've been a reporter for almost 15 years, a lot of it as an investigative reporter. And over the years, I've done a fair number of stories looking at institutional response to and cover-up of sexual assault. And I really started looking into this as a reporter at the Boston Phoenix in 2001 when I wrote some of the first stories on a pedophile priest there named John Gagan. And I looked at the Archdiocese of Boston's cover-up of his six decades worth of abuse. So over the years, I've done a fair number of stories, and in April 2008, I spoke at a panel at a conference sponsored by the Poynter Institute and the DART Society. The conference was for reporters. It was on covering sexual violence, and its audience was primarily daily crime reporters. And its audience was also victim advocates, and the idea was meant to bridge these two groups that deal with sexual assault, and these two groups often view each other warily. So the point was to show how there's mutual interest in developing a relationship, and, you know, reporters should develop victim advocates as sources, and vice versa. Victim advocates should feel free to go to reporters, find reporters they feel responsibly cover sexual violence, and you know, blow the whistle on institutional cover-up. I mean, that's what I talked about on the panel. After the panel, a few victim advocates who work on college campuses approached me and mentioned the campus judiciary process. You really should look at how colleges and universities handle sexual assault complaints, and, you know, they adjudicate these cases. You may not realize it because you may think of them as felony crimes, but they do adjudicate these cases, and they don't necessarily do it very well. You should look at this. And, you know, another member of the DART Society, which is a group of reporters, all past fellows of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma, I'm a past fellow, also mentioned this to me as an area to look into, because, you know, nobody really has looked at this. And so those conversations kind of planted the seed in my head, and I started developing the idea from there, looking up past coverage of campus sexual assault cases, finding sources, doing interviews, and I really quickly realized that this was a topic that deserved serious investigation.
Well, give us a little summary of what the investigation concluded in terms of the way that these campus judicial systems have become a de facto criminal justice system in which very serious criminal allegations sometimes get handled without the normal safeguards and transparency that we associate with the court system.
Overall, we found that students who reported being the victim of a sexual assault on campus often face a litany of barriers that either assure their silence or leave them feeling victimized a second time. And we interviewed 33 female students who reported to their school administrations being raped by a fellow student. We interviewed more students than that, but these 33 female students actually reported, and if they didn't go through the process, they tried to go through the process. Just over half of the students we interviewed, interestingly, said that they unsuccessfully sought criminal charges. And instead, they had to seek justice in closed school-run proceedings that either led to light penalties or no punishment at all for their alleged assailants. You know, they really walked away feeling betrayed by a process that has little transparency or accountability. Nearly a third of the students said administrators discouraged them from pursuing rape complaints in the first place. They encouraged them to pursue maybe informal proceedings like mediations, which are non-adjudicatory and have no punishment attached to them. Or, you know, they painted the campus judicial proceeding in such a negative light that students felt like, you know, what was the point? Why go forward? And they just dropped the effort. They didn't bother filing a formal complaint, or if they did file a formal complaint, they had met such resistance from administrators that they withdrew their complaint. And then beyond these third, there were another dozen or so who said they had to abide by very strict confidentiality requirements, and sometimes they faced threats of punishment if they were to reveal certain details about their proceedings, you know, publicly.
So just to be clear, because I think that point deserves some emphasis, you have people who are showing up complaining that they've been victims of a serious crime, and they're being told, you, the complainant, will be punished if you talk publicly about this crime report.
Yes. I mean, a lot of the problems that we found arise oftentimes because the campus judicial process is a closed process, unlike civil or criminal courts. It's a closed process. And required confidentiality can complicate matters for alleged victims. I mean, we found some schools have implemented policies over the years that act as gag orders on student victims. You know, they're either told verbally or they're expected to sign in writing agreements not to talk about their case. Other schools have threatened students if they talked about their cases. You know, they could face disciplinary action, including expulsion, if they talked about key details of their case. Sometimes even if they acknowledged or spoke about the fact that they were going through a proceeding. So it was really meant to you know, keep these cases quiet, these policies. I don't see any other, I mean, that's certainly the effect of these kinds of policies, is to keep these cases quiet. But, you know, other kinds of, we saw other ways in which, you know, sexual assault proceedings kind of enveloped in secrecy. We found some schools kept the alleged victim in the dark about not just the proceedings, but the hearing results. Some schools treated the alleged victim, the accusing student, as a witness to her own alleged assault. She was not considered an equal party, so that she couldn't, you know, it wasn't a hearing in which she could present her side of the case and the accused student could present his side of the case, and she was privy to the entire proceeding. It was a situation where she was treated as a, quote, witness, and the accused student, she had no access to the accused student's testimony, had no access to other witnesses' testimony, and couldn't, you know, wasn't part of the process in that way. Or we found situations where students, the alleged victims, filed complaints, were told that a proceeding would happen, a panel proceeding typically would happen, would follow. They, you know, didn't participate in any panel proceeding. You know, next thing they know, they found out about the hearing outcome. So getting from A to B was a complete mystery to them. They had no idea what had taken place during this proceeding. And then we also found, you know, a real interesting pattern of schools not even telling alleged victims the hearing outcomes, just keeping that from them altogether. These practices weren't across the board, but they recurred enough to suggest a real problem, a real systemic problem.
One of the other aspects of your research looked at the statistical reporting of crime and raised some questions about the accuracy of the figures that schools point out. Can you talk a little bit about what you observed there?
Sure. That was the third story. And that story really did look at we called it the underreporting story. It exposed limitations and loopholes in the CLERI Act, which is the federal mandatory crime reporting law, that we, particularly with the loopholes, that we believe schools are stretching and exploiting to keep their sexual assault numbers artificially low. We quote campus police in that article who point out that sometimes the zero sexual offenses reflect the fact that rape is an underreported crime, period. But I think that the numbers, I mean, we found basically that 77% of schools, meaning four-year public and private universities, 77% of them, even with, you know, student populations in the tens of thousands, are reporting zero sexual offenses, which is a staggering number if you think about it.
Right. So hardly seems like it can be possible.
I mean, it certainly seems incredible.
Yeah.
That all these schools would have not one sexual offense reported to not just campus police, but a campus security authority as defined by the CLERI Act, which is a pretty broad definition and would include deans, coaches, resident life directors, a whole list of people that you would think one student on that campus might have gone to and reported. And I mean, one of the biggest loopholes that we found was an exemption that does exist in the law for counselors. It's for mental health and pastoral counselors.
Right. So in other words, if a student goes and makes the report not to a law enforcement officer or not to some other authority figure, but rather to seek counseling, that may not get logged in the same way that it would if she reported it like she was reporting a crime, correct?
Yes. But a licensed counselor is someone who's acting as a therapist to a student. And, you know, the exemption, the education department in 2000, you know, created this regulatory exemption and basically said mental health counselors and pastoral counselors do not have to include their numbers and forward their numbers to a school's Clery reporter so that they'll be incorporated into the school's Clery statistics. But even education department officials that we interviewed readily acknowledged that this is a loophole that's being stretched. And it's being stretched to include people who may be licensed counselors, but on their campuses, they're not acting as therapists. You know, their position is not a therapist per se. They may be a victim advocate, so that they're a frontline responder, you know, a sexual assault services coordinator, for instance, somebody who is overseeing sexual assault services on campus may not be acting in a day-to-day basis as a therapist. And, you know, so there are people who may be licensed counselors that aren't acting as counselors, yet their numbers are not being included, or their schools, we found to be very, very common, are simply exempting the entire counseling center on campus, which is kind of like the most logical place for a student who's identifying herself as a victim to go. You know, the experts that we talked to, the Clery experts that we talked to, basically said that, you know, this is really overreaching, because, you know, you can collect statistics in the aggregate that do not reveal any identifying information about patients and include them in your Clery statistics. And a lot of schools we found, you know, the schools that are collecting data in a more comprehensive manner have somebody designated from the counseling center, somebody on the staff who's not acting as a licensed therapist, an intake person, for instance, who's simply just taking the calls, right? Collecting statistics and forwarding statistics in the aggregate, not revealing any identifying information to the Clery reporter on that campus so that numbers from the counseling center can be represented. But we did find, you know, very, very common that schools simply exempt the entire counseling center. And the position that I thought was really gray was the victim advocate or the sexual assault response team leader, the person on the front lines, the designated person on the front lines on a campus who's going to respond to a call or a report of rape immediately. And some schools are collecting these numbers and including them in Clery statistics, and other schools, the vast majority, are not. And, you know, the experts that we talked to, the Clery experts have said, you know, any place or person that's designated as the place or person students should go to report crimes and receive services really should be part of the reporting process. Their numbers should be included. And obviously that doesn't happen. That's not happening if you're on a campus that's touting zero sexual offenses.
Right. Well, that's a terrific tip for the student journalists who are listening to us, that, you know, if you obtain a copy of your school's Cleary report and you see a big fat zero under the sexual assault statistics, your job isn't over then, and it may be, in fact, a disservice to the public to simply report that zero and create the false impression that this is a crime-free campus. At that point, your job is just beginning, and it's time to start asking some more questions about, well, what went into the formulation of this report, and what do you classify as a reportable sexual offense or not? Let me ask you at that point, it's so interesting that even though these proceedings are so secretive, that you had such success in tracking down so many victims and getting them to tell their stories to you, can you talk a little bit for the journalists listening about, you know, how you went about the research, how you went about finding the sources and finding the records, and maybe some tips that you can share there?
Sure. I mean, well, one of the very first things we did was to survey crisis services programs on campuses and clinics, crisis services clinics connected to colleges. Mm-hmm. And we did this across the country. But I would say if you're if you're one student reporter on a campus, you could easily simply just go to the crisis service program and conduct your own informal background survey. I mean, all it was some initial questions to help us understand the landscape. We asked immediately about incidents of sexual assaults and kind of the makeup of those assaults. You know, what's the typical relationship between victim and offender? Is it primarily student-on-student sexual assault that's happening? Is it faculty on student? Do you have those cases? What's the percentage? Is it primarily male on female? You know, kind of understanding what sexual assault on that campus looks like. We asked about services, and we asked about policies and procedures that the campus had in place for adjudicating the cases. And that allowed us to develop a lot of sources, through follow-up interviews with the survey. So we developed a lot of sources with victim advocates, with crisis service coordinators on campus, and people who were on the front lines, some of whom led us to students. The hardest thing, as you said, was identifying students who filed rape complaints. And I mean, we did this through old-fashioned shoe leather reporting. I mean, we contacted people who would be in contact with students who are going to report rape. So that's your victim advocate on campus. If there's a student activist group around this issue, we went there. For instance, one of the things we did was to post email queries on blogs like Safer, Students Active Against Active for Ending Rape, and V-Day, and other campus-focused organizations, basically saying, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm interested in investigating how colleges adjudicate rape complaints. I'm seeking students who reported being raped and who went through a campus disciplinary process as a result. And we sent those queries around across the country, and we got students who responded. If they weren't somebody who went through the process, they knew somebody who did, and they forward our information along. We searched. We did court searches for every Title IX lawsuit filed against a school over the last 10 years because of the way it responded to a rape complaint, and we contacted attorneys who've handled those kinds of cases, and we found students that way. We went to organizations like Security on Campus and the Victim Rights Law Center, two organizations whose lawyers and advocates have helped students file complaints against schools for the way they responded. We went to Take Back the Night events on campuses, and we tried to meet student activists on the ground involved in this issue who were, pushing their administrations on policy. They typically know other students. They typically, if they haven't gone through the process themselves, they typically know students who do. So it was kind of circling the sources who would be in contact with students. That's what we did is that's how we found students. I mean, we also filed Freedom of Information Act requests for 10 years worth of complaints filed against schools.
What kind of a response did you get on that? Because that's been obviously quite a frustrating process for students at a lot of schools that, understandably, given the secrecy with which they cloak these processes, schools are not often eager to turn loose of these records.
Well, we filed the FOIA request with the Education Department, and it was for Title IX and Clery Act complaints filed against schools, 10 years worth. It was a fight to get those documents, because we got thousands of pages of documents, and it took a long time to get those documents. I think what you're referring to is trying to get a student's judicial file.
Right.
We interviewed as many students as possible, and we built this reporting database, based on their interviews, and we identified commonalities in their cases. In an Excel spreadsheet, we could see commonalities in their cases, and we organized the stories around these story angles, and then we chose cases that were most illustrative of these story angles to report further. And when we did that, we asked students to, if they had their entire judicial case file, to give it to us, and some students did. Some students were at schools where they got the entire judicial case file. They had all of their statements. They had all the accused students' statements. They had all policy and procedures laid out. They had the judicial hearing board transcript. They had everything. And we got that from them if they had it. And if they didn't have it, because a lot of students only had maybe the disposition letter that said, so-and-so was found responsible for sexual assault, after a hearing, based on your complaint kind of thing. If that's all they got, then we had them sign privacy waivers so that we could file a records request with the school asking for documents stemming from the judicial panel proceedings related to the rape report. And, we only had one student's privacy waiver. So sometimes schools gave us everything and only redacted the name of the accused student because we didn't have the accused student's waiver. Sometimes schools redacted huge portions of the record, anything related to, something that they thought might identify the accused student. So sometimes we got huge redactions, and sometimes we got everything, including the accused student's name. So it really varied, and it depended on the individual school and how they were interpreting the privacy waiver and our FOIA. We also helped students if they were at a private university. We helped them file FERPA requests for their documents, and we got a lot of documents that way. If a student was from a private school, that's how, a private university, that's how we did it. They filed a FERPA request. They asked for their judicial file, and they got information back that way. And, we had to push, and I think the students, we basically, if we didn't hear from a school, the school has 45 days to respond to a FERPA request. We didn't hear from a school, acknowledging the request. We had the student follow up with emails. If there were problems, we helped the student navigate. Like if the school was saying, you're not entitled to this, we helped the student navigate. And we were basically willing to, file a FERPA complaint with the education department on the student's behalf if they didn't get their records. But all the students got their records. Some of them weren't allowed to make copies. And under FERPA, you don't have to make copies. You don't have to make copies. It's simply allowing students to see their file.
Right. Well, let me kind of go over two points just by way of re-emphasis, because I think they're just such terrific reporting tips. One is that you mentioned the Title IX litigation, because Title IX is a federal anti-sex discrimination statute, and it is possible for a student who feels that she's been exposed to essentially a hostile environment on campus, that her safety hasn't been protected, to bring a lawsuit in court against the university. And at that point, now you're outside of the jurisdiction of the campus court, and so many of the facts that would otherwise be concealed on campus become public domain by virtue of being in the court record. So always consider, as a reporter, court records. They're your friend. There's much more information available there frequently than there is through your own campus. The other is getting the cooperation of the person that you're working with. As you mentioned, FERPA. FERPA is a dirty word to a lot of student journalists because it is quoted to them very often to reject and refuse their open records requests. But FERPA also entitles the student herself to get her own school records upon request. And so if you have a cooperating source who's willing to share that with you or who's willing to execute a waiver of their FERPA confidentiality, you may be able to get much more than if you just walked in and knocked on the front door yourself as a journalist. So those are both terrific reporting tips. Just in the couple of minutes that we have left, Kristen, anything else by way of tips, advice, lessons learned that you might convey if somebody who's listening to this is a college journalist and is interested in maybe looking into, well, how are these cases handled on my campus, and are those statistics reliable on my campus?
Well, we did develop a reporter's toolkit, and it's on our website, www.publicintegrity.org. If you go to the projects site, you'll see a reporter's toolkit, and it really takes you through the three laws that come into play if you're going to look at how schools adjudicate sexual assault. And those are FERPA and Title IX and the Clery Act. And I think one of the most basic things you can do, for any student reporter could do, just to start covering this topic, is to look at the Clery statistics on your campus and start asking questions around the reporting process for collecting Clery data. I mean, we found that this was a great starting point, because you have your official statistics. If you go to the counseling center on your campus, or if your campus has an office of victim assistance, or if it has a victim advocacy program, for instance, or a sexual assault response team, and you get their numbers of incidents, you can immediately look at discrepancies and start asking questions around why the discrepancies. How does the administration collect Clery data? Who do they consider campus security authority, and why? If the counseling center isn't exempt, why isn't it exempt? It shouldn't be a blanket exemption. Try to figure out, whose numbers are being included. And that's a great way to actually develop sources around this topic. You would be talking to victim advocates, judicial affairs administrators, campus police, and you'd be able to develop sources who might actually lead you to students who've gone through the process. I mean, all you need to do is ask. I'm looking to talk to students who've gone through the process. That's all we did, is ask. And a lot of people, just don't think people are interested in this subject matter. Maybe you might find some sources who are protective and don't want to. I mean, you don't have to say, I'd like the names of students. You would say, I'm interested in investigating how the school's implementing Title IX. And the best way to do that is to look at how it's adjudicating these cases. And I'd love to talk to students who've gone through the process, who filed a rape complaint and have gone through the process. Here's my information. And you'd be surprised at the fact that you'll get a response. I mean, I do think you'll get a response, because we did get a lot of students. I mean, you might find initially students who never reported, and you're going to want to look for students who reported. And they didn't just report, they went through the judicial process. But I think developing sources is the best thing to do. And then going to events on campus where this is actually being discussed. I mean, there are 2 months every year, as I understand it, one in the fall and one in the spring, and April is a big Sexual Assault Awareness Month, where there's a lot of activities on campuses around this topic. And I would just show up and meet people and start asking questions and say, I'd like to look into this. I'm really interested in this. And that's how I think you know, showing up is how you, is like half of the work in terms of developing sources.
Half of being an effective reporter, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Kristen, thanks so much for the practical tips and advice that you have given, and thanks for the terrific work that you and the Center for Public Integrity have done helping draw public attention to the need for greater transparency and accountability in the way that colleges are handling sexual assault. We're going to have to wrap it up there, but for college journalists who want to review Kristen Lombardi's wonderful stories, do check out the publicintegrity.org website. And if you are interested in getting more active in monitoring campus crime and monitoring the activities of your campus law enforcement agencies, we encourage you to visit the SPLC's website, www.splc.org, and email us at splc@splc.org if you would like a free copy of our updated reference guide covering campus crime. Please check out all the news and all the reference materials on the splc.org website. Become a fan of the Student Press Law Center on Facebook and follow SPLC_org on Twitter. And if you are a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about your legal rights, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.